This is going to be my comments at least, and they'll promptly end within half an hour or less. Will be a very quick overview of a number of thoughts about what's happened in our society's consideration of death, with an angle toward putting it in a larger system-wide context, I call it, considering some of the economic costs as well as some of the other considerations involved in death and dying decisions. I'll touch on the law at times, though I'm not a legal scholar, and I'll end with a case that's become very widely known in Minnesota, at least, and to some extent in the national newspapers, the Helga Langley case out of Minneapolis, and a comment on some of the good and bad arguments for the aid in dying provision of Washington's Initiative 119. At any rate, a lot of that is my personal observations. I don't mean this to be a scholarly overview at all, but just throwing out a number of thoughts that I have on these matters. The title is the second part of the title, We All Owe God a Death, is a quote from Shakespeare, which was used by Governor Lamb, of Colorado, former Governor Lamb now, of Colorado 5 years ago when he got in real big trouble. And it was quoted in the newspaper the next day saying people have a duty to die. He did not say people have a duty to die. If you check his speech, he said, he ended with a quote from Shakespeare, but was particularly vigorous about it that night. His mood was particularly vigorous, apparently. The quote from Shakespeare that we all owe God a death. The context was his own survey of the use of economic resources in healthcare, and his own view that, in fact, the system is out of control, and furthermore, a lot of people would say it's sort of out of control, the cost of healthcare, but his view that that has very serious repercussions on both the economy of our country now and in the future, and also on certain abilities of our society, or the will of our society, and the will of our society to care for certain other disadvantaged groups, including children, the amount of resources we're putting there, for example. Okay, I won't say more about Governor Lamb's position, and I won't say more about the quotation, we all owe God a death. So I do want to put this in the context of an overall theme, which I think is the stewardship of resources. I think this is one of the forgotten elements in the way individuals, not the way politicians, but the way individuals approach these decisions at the end of life. First of all, a couple comments about the overall healthcare system. As you may or probably know, healthcare costs are over $700 billion in 1990. And this is a somewhat old focus, but the figures would be even more impressive now. Since 1950, we've grown from 5% of GNP to, in 87, 11.4% of GNP, and 12.3% of GNP or so in 1990. The rate of growth has virtually always, or you can hardly find a year when it hasn't been 6% above the rate of inflation. And sometimes it's been higher, sometimes maybe a point lower than that. Hospital room day rate in 22 years there tripled after discounting for inflation. General Motors health is a tidbit. Health insurance expenditure in 1987 was $4,000 per employee. It's now $5,800 per employee and costs now between $600 and $700 per car that General Motors produces. The Japanese spend about 40%, between a third. Calculations internationally are very, very difficult to make. There are lots of things that don't quite line up. But it's somewhere between a third and 40% of what the United States spends on healthcare. So right there, you've got about a $350, $400 price break for the average car made in Japan compared to the U.S. Other international comparisons are interesting. This is very recent data. This was published in the New York Times. Sorry about the bad slide, but this is what happens when you make these things off a newspaper copy. The top line is the United States, the dotted line below it is Germany, the solid green line is Canada, the next solid line is France, then Japan, and then Britain. Notice that Germany was as high as the U.S. back in 1970, virtually. But now a major gap is what opened up. This is despite the fact that Germans have very good insurance, number one. And number two, that German insurance is not centralized and capped in what we might call a global budget cap. So there's some things happening in Germany, despite the fact they don't have a centralized control of costs, that are quite different than the last 20 years of what has happened in the United States. Lots of other interesting international comparisons we could go into. If an economist is going to look at just the basics of the U.S. healthcare economy, I would suspect an economist would list something like this. Or if a Martian economist were to land on Earth and look at the healthcare economies, these would be some of the outstanding features. How is it paid for? Healthcare is paid for 50% by private insurance, 25% by public insurance, and less than 25% out of pocket. Financing is where do the funds come from, not the channel they go through. Medicare, through a payroll tax, which is quite regressive, as everyone knows. And Medicaid through general tax revenue. Employer paid premiums subsidize the largest proportion by far of private insurance. And that, all employer paid premiums are subsidized 40% on the dollar by the tax break. And that is a regressive tax break. This is a lot, very frequently forgotten fact about the way we financed healthcare in the United States. That is, when an employer buys your healthcare by paying your health insurance premium, it's excluded from taxable income. No income tax, no Social Security tax paid by you, no Social Security tax paid by the employer, no state and local income tax paid. That's a 40%+ break. A higher break for higher income people, a lower break for some of the lower income people, and above all, a very good break only for well-employed people. That is, people who have employers that buy their insurance, not other people who may be buying insurance in the market.
Right, is that 40% figure outdated with the top marginal rate now at 33%?
Not at all. Take 33, it's going to be 50% for many people. 33 plus 7.8 Social Security plus another 7.8 employers paid Social Security. You're at 49 or 48.5 right there.
The marginal rate of 28.
It's still over 40.
The
marginal rate of 28 is still over 40. Even though the marginal rate of 15, it's over 30. The average is still well over 40. All political attempts to cap this have died quickly. I'll talk a little bit more about that, perhaps at the forum on Thursday night on healthcare access and reform of the system. Another outstanding fact is that provider reimbursement is largely fee-for-service in the United States, though there is some what is called managed care, that is, providers get collected and in some of the classic cases paid directly as a salary by, say, a health maintenance organization, but largely it's fee-for-service. Now, given our insurance, given the fact that the lion's share of care is provided through insurance, paid for through insurance, given that it's paid for through a combination of a government subsidy plus Medicare, the largest shares of it, and given the fact that the providers are largely paid fee-for-service, it is absolutely no surprise at all that the United States has vastly escalating healthcare costs in the last 25 years. I mean, it couldn't be otherwise. Once people have those kinds of financial incentives, providers are going to want to do everything, regardless of cost, that will benefit an individual patient and that the individual patient consents to. Individuals will want everything done for them, regardless of cost, as long as the net benefit to them, not considering cost once they're insured, is greater than zero. Even if it's a tiny benefit and costs enormous amounts of money, if they're not paying for it, if the family's not paying for it, there's not any incentive to hold back, and it certainly is against, in fact, directly against traditional medical ethic to not prescribe care for a person, even if the benefit is minuscule, as long as it's greater than zero net, regardless of what it costs. So it's absolutely no mystery that we've got a healthcare system which is outstripping even other very good healthcare systems in the world by 2% of GNP in what we spend on. Now, one thing people have noted about this, and there are a lot of misconceived figures on this, I hear figures up to 50%, 60%, 75% when I hear ask people what they think the proportion of healthcare is that's spent in the last year of life. But in fact, it's high, but it's not, I mean, it's significant, but it's not all that high. sorry about the slightly faint slide here. The healthcare cost of dying, the best study I know of was done in 85. I've looked at a couple of updatings of this, but they're not as detailed, so I stick with the old one. And I'm sorry about the typo in the middle, it required a change, pencil change there. 18% of all healthcare is used in the last year of life. 12% of all healthcare is used in the last month of life. Persons over 65 who die within 1 year use over 10% of healthcare in the whole system, which is over 1% of GNP, if we're using more than 12% of our GNP on healthcare. Percent of Medicare enrollees who die within 1 year is 5.9%, but those 5.9% spend 27.9% of Medicare dollars. Now someone might say after this, it's those big expenses at the end of life that we ought to cut out and we can save a lot of money. Well, not so. There's no panacea here. First of all, it's only 18% or 12%, and that's worth saving, all right. But in terms of the larger system, that's not all of the problem. Secondly, you can't just cut this out because you don't know ahead of time who the people are who are going to die within a month. Take the 1 month figure. Suppose we said, definitely. 12% of the healthcare, that is about $85 billion, is not worth just one more month of life for those people who it does help. And some people it doesn't even help that much. Let's just cut it out. Well, if we knew who those people were, fine, let's cut it out. But the problem is we don't often know. Now, sometimes we do know, but there's a chance that it won't be just a month of life. It might be 5 years. And so we gamble. There are all kinds of psychological forces here that make it very difficult indeed in any policy kind of way to say, let's cut out care in the last month of life. My approach to this is somewhat different, that there are a lot of things that individuals can do personally, and that there are also some things that the system can do in terms of having a priority system of rationing care, but I won't talk about that today. But more tomorrow in relation to the age qualification. Some larger system things that can be done, but those things don't pertain just to care in the last month of life. And secondly, the things that can be done in the last month of life are things that ought to be done by individuals. And that there's a lot of consciousness raising that can be done about this, which can be, I would argue, not only helpful to society as a whole and to individuals, but in my view of things, a kind of very faithful way of stewarding the resources of the human community. And I'll get to that theme later. So on the one hand, there's little to do. On the other hand, in direct relation to these costs, little to do that we can do just by saying, hey, let's cut that out. There are also, however, I don't want to to deflate the seriousness of the problem. In some ways, almost all the estimates you hear about what particular procedures cost in the latter years of life are underestimates. I'll explain why. You see a lot of cost analyses going on in the medical literature and economic medical literature these days. And they'll come out saying, for example, that, to take one example that's rather striking, if you move from doing pap smears on women under 50 from every 3 years to every year, the gain you get in terms of years of life saved for, in relation to dollars spent, is 1 year of life saved for every $1,400,000 spent. That's the gain you get in moving from a pap smear on women under 50 from 3 years to every 1 year. That's pretty exorbitant spending in terms of health productivity. Now, there are also psychological reassurances, all sorts of things like that. It's complicated to weigh all that in. But there's a case, I think it's very clear, where people would say, by just looking at a good cost-benefit analysis, we can decide that certain care should not be given. And we ourselves would think that's rather exorbitant spending on my health. I hope that's that I'm not speaking in any discriminatory way there just because I'm a man. I would hope that as a male, I would say the same thing about similar procedures. But there are a lot of cost-benefit analyses, you see, that are underestimates of the cost per year of life saved, or per life saved. Whoops, this one doesn't quite fit on. There we go. Take penicillin for pneumonia in a nursing home. Generally, the figures you'll see on that are, well, $50 for the penicillin and the administration of it. It's cheap, it's quick, and you cure the pneumonia rather quickly. What is the real cost of that piece of health care? I would argue it's more like this, and this is per year, because when you save a life in that situation, you're incurring a lot more costs than the immediate care. You're incurring the cost of later follow-up health care. As Dan Callahan has pointed out in a number of his books, which I'll be plugging more tomorrow, Setting Limits, the bookstore has that one. People don't just live once you spend a certain amount of money on them. They live and then they have another problem and then they spend more on that to have them live. So if we're really looking at what it costs to maintain life in a situation where one is dying, when we look at it globally for one's life, it would be a lot more than what the usual estimates are. The cost of pneumonia to cure, the cost of penicillin to cure pneumonia is, I would argue, $35,000 per year of life saved. In fact, you save the person for 3 years, that's $100,000. It's a $100,000 piece of care.
How do you come up with that figure?
I'm sorry, for those of you who didn't understand. $24,000 a year for nursing home care, $3,000 a year for medical care, $8,000 a year in pension benefits being paid out in their remaining, their extra years of life, compared to if they had died now.
So you're assuming that if someone gets pneumonia, they automatically are going to require nursing home care?
Let's suppose that is the situation. Let's suppose this is not a situation where by curing the pneumonia, they could be out of the nursing home in a month. And then suppose we're talking about a almost for sure, well, for sure, chronic long-term care patient. And these are not unreal cases. There are plenty of real cases of that sort of thing. And we know that at the time we're dealing with. Now, I do not want to use this figure to argue that people should die when it's just too expensive. First of all, there's a very delicate problem of deciding what's too expensive and what life is worth. My approach to this would be to go back to what I think is the central principle we have used in letting people die, if we just think of it regardless of cause. One of the principles that our society has adopted pretty much across the board legally in our society, though there are all kinds of nuances in particular situations, is that the society cannot objectively define the value of life. And in fact, that the determination of the value of life is to be left up to the individual. We therefore say that people can refuse even life-saving care. Especially, the first step we took was they can refuse life-saving care in terminal illness situations. But we've now said that because of difficulties, especially in defining what a terminal illness is, what, you're going to die within 6 months? Going to die within 6 years. If you look at why terminal illness is an important criterion, it's because people say, well, given that I perceive this as a terminal illness, my life, given the problems I suffer from in continuing to live, is not worth extending at this point. It's a very personal decision, but if they decide that, why should they not also be able to decide it in quasi-terminal situations, or maybe even in non-terminal situations? The courts, in fact, have come increasingly to say that the terminal, quasi-terminal, non-terminal line is an irrelevant line. And so they have backed up Elizabeth Bouvier's request, for example, to go without food and water. She's a cerebral palsy patient who has said, I choose to die now. Don't keep me alive with artificial food and water. Even though she's not terminally ill. Many Alzheimer's patients are not terminally ill. Now, once we step over, however, into someone like the Alzheimer's patient, we're into a quite different problem. Because there, obviously, the person is not competent, or in many cases would not be competent. There we get into advanced directives. So society has picked up this value of self-determination. Not the society determining objectively what the value of life is, but the individual determining what the value of life is for themselves, and said that can be applied in even incompetent patient cases. And there are three ways to do that. One is by advance directive, The problems with that are, how do you really state the circumstances in which you would want to be let die, allowed to die? Durable power of attorney, in which you say, well, I can't state the precise circumstances, but I know that I want person X to make the decision because they know my values the best, or whatever other reason I have. So you give them so-called durable power of attorney. And the third way is simply for people, even in cases regardless, in cases where there isn't an advance directive that the patient has written, where there isn't durable power of attorney authority given to a particular person to make the decision, where people nonetheless will say, well, just because they're incompetent and haven't left us this information or assigned this authority, still isn't our loyalty to them best carried out by trying to decide what they would have decided if they could look down on themselves now as a competent super person seeing their incompetent life. And so we extrapolate from other things they say that in fact they would want not to have heroic measures used on them in a particular circumstance. The principle behind all that, even in the cases where the patient is incompetent, I would argue, is the principle of self-determination. Now, it gets very tricky in the cases, especially where the patient is incompetent. It's even tricky in the advanced directive cases because of the problems of interpretation. It's especially competent in incompetent cases because we just can't be sure what that person would have said. And there's lots of room for argument about what the person would have said. But then we try to make a judgment about what that person's best interest would have been. Could we come to some agreement within families, between families and physician, wherever the circle of people involved, maybe as a society, if it gets to a court, that in fact it is not an unreasonable request to die, and our best guess would be that it is in the best interests of this person to be allowed to die at this point. We've even taken that step of reading a person's best interest or a person's will when they're incompetent. Now, we've also stiffened those measures by lawsuits. I think this is important to note. There have been a few lawsuits in the last couple of years in which healthcare providers have been taken to court because they did not abide by advance directives or the wishes of a person with durable power of attorney. There's a famous nursing home case out of, I think it was Pennsylvania. That is increasingly binding providers. So providers used to be afraid of lawsuits. I can't resist a cartoon here. They're especially in the audience with some seminarians here. Lord, how can that couple slap me with a $1 million malpractice suit just because I married them and they're splitting up? How can people blame somebody else for their own problems like that? How can they shift responsibility? How can they pass the buck? What am I going to do, Lord? Seminary never prepared me for this. Maybe I can sue the seminary. Now, there's been a lot of talk about the rampant lawsuits in society. The lawsuits that have heretofore and still do create what physicians call defensive medicine, prescribing things out of fear that if they don't prescribe them, they'll be sued. Some of that's turning around 180 degrees, and physicians are being sued for prescribing. This is as the legal procedures about carrying out people's interests and values in these dying situations get solidified in the society. Providers just won't be able to use the excuse anymore. Well, if I don't keep the person alive, I'll get sued. Sometimes it's the other way around. I would argue that the crucial question there is prior consent. We try to extrapolate what the person's wishes would have been if they're not competent at the time. If they are competent at the time, of course, we should take their wishes as stated then. Assuming, of course, we've ruled out this very awful danger that we're twisting their arms and getting them to say something they don't really want. Now, I would argue that when we get to the money question, what society has previously thought of as arm twisting is no longer necessarily arm twisting. We previously said to ourselves, we can't ask Uncle Charlie to die because his care in the next year is going to cost $100,000. Because that's saying Uncle Charlie's life isn't worth in itself the sanctity that we have said life has. And the $100,000 is going to other people, not to Charlie. And it's not even going to causes, Charlie believes in. It's just going to second chickens and people's pots and et cetera. So we've thought of bringing in the economic fact, even mentioning it to a patient or a family in that situation, or the family using it to read the decision of an incompetent relative, to read the values of an incompetent relative as illegitimate arm twist. But I would argue that we're at a point now where the economic question has become quite different. That in fact, just take a very simple case. There are many cases of sorts of care in the last stages of life that people know are going to run from $50,000 to $100,000 if they live another month or so. That's a house. If that were to go to Habitat for Humanity, for example, that's two houses. Now, we steward resources over our lifetimes. So if we put ourselves back before that particular point in time, and we can still do that at that particular point, suppose we're dying and we're conscious, but we're saying, now how would I want resources used over just my lifetime? Would I previously had invested resources in things like $70,000 in the last month of life, if I had thought about this beforehand? No. If I could have had any control over those resources at all, I would have said the $70,000 should go to my church or Habitat for Humanity or whatever cause I believe. Or maybe even just thanks for my grandchildren, or maybe other things that are frivolous but important enough that other people think are frivolous but important enough in my mind. So if people put themselves back at a prior point in time and think about stewarding resources over a lifetime, remember, where do resources come from? They come from people's lifetimes. They are produced. Resources are produced. The healthcare resources, at least. The resources that go into providing healthcare have to be produced by someone. They're produced by human beings in their lifetime. If they steward those resources, people thinking about this seriously beforehand, I would argue, would be very willing indeed to say, if they could look at the whole life picture, they would say, no, doc, that's enough. I know there's still some benefit for me, slight, in this last month, maybe even very precious, but it's just not worth it. I'd rather the resources go to something else. Now, we've seen that as arm twist, but I think we're at a state where families and individuals should start considering that. It's not an illegitimate or evil thought. I would regard it, as long as one stays away from certain obvious abuses of it, or even subtle abuses of that thought, that it is part of our stewardship of resources. Okay, let me talk just very briefly about the Helga Wangland case. This is the Minnesota case. I can see I won't get to Initiative 119, but that's a less integral part of what I was going to say. This is a fascinating case in Minnesota. A woman, 87, ventilator and feeding tube dependent, unaware of and unresponsive to her surroundings. Doctors say she'll never recover and that continued life prolonging care is futile. The family, the two children, and the doctors agree that she will not recover from persistent vegetative state that she is now in. There's no disagreement on the medical prognosis at all, not one iota of disagreement. But the husband says that Helga said, only he who gave life has the right to take life, though she did not leave that in writing nor write an advance directive about medical care. He interprets that, though it's not an undisputable interpretation by any means, he interprets that to mean that she would want to be kept alive even when she is permanently unconscious. The family, the doctors believe that in fact this is simply futile care, that the purpose of medicine is not keep people alive when they have no capacity whatsoever to appreciate anything in life. The doctors went to court to try to get the authority to override the family's wishes by saying it's futile care. The court backed up the family, the district court backed up the family. I don't know whether it's not going to be appealed because she died 2-3 weeks ago, after the court decision. At any rate, I think the family is right in one respect, this is not futile care. Why is it not futile care even though she's permanently unconscious? Because once we are unconscious, or once we're dead, what is our interest? One of our most important interests, earthly interests yet, even after we're dead. So that if, for example, Nancy Cruzan's family says, don't keep her alive, even though Nancy Cruzan, or in the case of a year and a half ago, is permanently unconscious, it is in fact in her interest to die. Even though she's not in any pain by staying alive, it's in her interest to die because the people closest to her would rather see her die without using up those resources, and they see no benefit to her in continuing to live. But the reverse is true in Helga Wangley's case. The people closest to her say she should be kept alive. So this is not futile care, and it's largely on that basis, I think, that the court decided that the doctors were wrong. They were trying to objectively define futility instead of leaving it up to the person and the person's surrogate, family, to define that subject. So they're right on it. I think they're right on it. Now, one other thing, however. The cost of Helga Wangley's care, just since this January, when the court case started, is $700,000. And I would argue that if Helga Wangley, that if the family took a broader view of Helga Wangley's wishes here, they would say, stewarding resources over lifetimes, no way. Her life has value now because of what we read her values to be, but it doesn't have enough value to justify that investment of resources. Is that callous? Is that crass? It's certainly abusable thinking. One could say it's dangerous thinking, but I think it's virtually inevitable that society get into this. My preference would be for individuals and families to start wrestling with this very, very directly and a lot, so that it doesn't just become a matter of society taking all these decisions into global policy rules. No, you can't have care once it costs that much, though I will argue tomorrow that sometimes that's justified too. I've gone over my own time limit by 1 minute. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Also, in this case, it's interesting that to me, the kind of medical care that Helga was being given was in fact mechanical and intrusive. God had already taken her life. It was, I mean, well, the medical community was keeping her alive with a ventilator and with the feeding tubes. Would you, I know that's a very...
If we said that the intrusiveness of care meant that you could remove care, or that you even, the intrusiveness of care meant you should remove care, even that, then we would not do virtually all the medicine we do.
Is medicine almost all medicine to the point where sometimes they don't start care like that because they don't want to have to then, say, 6 months down the road, try to figure out a way to stop it?
Certainly one of the things we don't want people to do in the healthcare system, I think, this is just my own analysis of this, is to say we won't start this care because once we start it, we won't be permitted to take it off, morally or legally mm-hmm. permitted to take it off. That would be terrible because sometimes starting care produces great things. Yeah. We see within a couple of weeks that it is in fact going to be very effective and the person is going to have a life that in their terms is worth living after that. But sometimes it doesn't work out that way. To keep providers and families from being so fearful of the bad possible result that they don't even start what might possibly be a good producing care, we should let people start, but also we must give them the freedom to withdraw once they start. Furthermore, the mere intrusiveness doesn't settle the question because many very intrusive procedures, people say, are very, very highly desired. I mean, open heart surgery is the most intrusive thing you can get, and yet people plead for it mm-hmm. at certain times. It depends on the patient's values and how they size a lot of different things up. Which, by the way, is the main reason, the main moral argument, despite the other things that are perhaps weaknesses in the position, is the main argument for stepping into permitting active means of dying. The Aid in Dying provision of Washington's Initiative 119 says that a physician is allowed to to help a terminally ill patient who is competent at the time, competent up to the last moment of death, and help them and assist them, lethal drugs, et cetera, to die. Highly restricted to competent patients and terminal competent patients. But the same value is at work there, self-determination. And the standard response to that, which is you can't interfere with nature, you shouldn't interfere with nature, be it said from a theological perspective, or be it said just from what often is regarded as the traditional view of the medical profession, that you can't actively kill, doesn't settle the issue, because we actively interfere with nature in all sorts of other medical situations. The interference with nature observation, it's correctable, right? We are interfering with nature if we give a person a lethal drug or give it to them so they can give it to themselves. But it doesn't settle the question, because interference with nature is something we do in many other circumstances. When do we do it? We do it when it serves human good. Assuming we're on the right track in perceiving what human good is, we wouldn't want to bar people from that active means. Now, there are many other dangers, obviously, in active euthanasia, but that's the driving moral force argument behind it. And there's absolutely no way we could have seen what we've seen in way of progress in giving people rights to determine their own care in life and death situations so far in the last 20, 25 years, namely primarily rights to refuse life-saving treatment. There's no way we could have done that with the value of self-determination pushing hard behind it without raising the question very seriously, not just through some crazy group. Hemlock Society is not a crazy group. That value just makes it inevitable that the question of when are active lethal means permissible, that it will become an issue in our society that we will have to settle. So I don't see the mere intrusiveness of the therapy in Helga Langley's case as the key. The key was whether continuing to live, the product that therapy produces, life in a persistent vegetative state, is that or is that not of value to Helga Langley? The family says it is. The doctors say futility is not a subjective notion. At a certain point, you cross over a line where it is an objective fact that certain care is futile. The court said, quite in line with the tradition of self-determination generally in other refusal of treatment cases, doctors can't determine.
Yes? In your opinion, how much of the accelerated discussion in the last 5-8 years is a result of the AIDS epidemic, and how much of the movement toward self-determination is rooted in some kind of homophobia?
My reaction is very little. Though care for terminally ill AIDS patients is itself a very graphic instance of many of the dilemmas that, in a quite different setting than I've been talking about. No, I don't think, people have pointed out that care of an AIDS patient in the last year of life costs $150,000 on the average. But I don't think that's the most agreed, and people therefore say, hey, you got to stop this life-sustaining care in hopeless cases. Wait a minute, I think people have gotten over that, and I don't think there's been a big push added by the AIDS cases to that. An extra year of life when you tragically find out at age 35 or 40 that you've got AIDS and you're probably going to die within a year is, I think, people standing back, even looking over their lifetime, would probably say is worth $140,000. I don't see people seizing on that as money wasted. It's on the borderline, all right. The question should be raised, but I don't see people coming to a quick answer in their perception after the initial question is raised. I think the more graphic cases are the cases of $700,000 for Helga Langley, or $30,000 after a series of cardiac arrests in which you know the chances are virtually nil that the person's going to ever leave the hospital or ever come back to a state of significant awareness. Those are the cases that are, it's those cases, I think, that are pushing the public perception of the cost. Oh, it could be. I don't think, this problem would be here if AIDS had never happened.
Can I say something?
Okay, I've been ignoring hands.
Yeah, just a couple things. There are more women that die of breast cancer in this country every year than people that die from AIDS. So the comment he made that, you know, AIDS is bringing this to the forefront, it's hard to say. But I just wanted to say that I like what you had to say in regards to we must each take our own responsibility to, you know, our own lives when we decide, you know, the quality is, we make our own decision. It's all in our own hands. The other question, though, I had for you in regards to the escalating costs of medicine, it was kind of unclear where you feel that 6% above inflation, where is that coming from? What's driving that?
I'm not an economist, so I can't give you a confident answer. But I read a few economists, and my understanding of the best work on that is that it's a very tough question to answer. You certainly have improvements in technology, which create costs. Now, sometimes improvements in technology save money, but very often they cost less. And on balance, if you look at take 20 representative technological improvements in the last 10 years. Number 13 has saved money, number 7 has saved money. You total all up. If they created or saved money in the healthcare system, not in the rest of society, but in the healthcare system, you'll find that generally technological improvements cost money. Another factor certainly is the aging of society. I think those are the two biggest factors. Technology improvements and aging of society. Then there are a lot of other little, smaller factors as well. Yes?
In regards to that gentleman there, the statistic about women's breast cancer, the statistics on that now are that there's 14 times as much money being spent on AIDS research than there is on breast cancer. And then another thing, I think the question here is, people should consider living wills, which my wife and I have.
Yeah, and that's what I meant by advanced directive.
For years, my wife and I have volunteered at hospitals, and I always called on all the Medicare patients. And when you would see what these patients go through keeping a person alive, it's unbelievable. And to see what the families go through, I've seen it for week after week, month after month, where their daughters and their sons, whatever, members of the family come and the person is there, no communication whatsoever. To keep a person like that alive, I think is a crime. That's why I think a living will is the answer to a problem like that.
Living wills are help, but I would argue they're not the final answer because of legitimate problems, not just made up problems by nervous physicians worried about lawsuits later. Legitimate problems in interpreting a living will. The more secure way legally is to appoint someone with durable power of attorney. Because then there are no ambiguities of interpretation of the words you left. What do heroic measures mean, for example? Well, sometimes a ventilator is an heroic measure and sometimes it isn't. Food and water, sometimes it just varies. But it helps. Advanced directives, living wills do help. The main reason, the biggest reason I think they help is that they are a communication facilitation device. They get people talking. They get the physician involved. They get the family talking, so you avoid family conflicts. And above all, they get the person who will die in the future talking frankly, initiating the discussion with the younger family members who otherwise feel they can't raise the issue. All that is very, very good. Living wills have done a lot to help that. But I would argue it's the process, not the document per se, that's the most important there. If we're looking at a legal device per se that's the most helpful, it would be durable power of attorney. Here, I think, first.
With respect to your comments on the stewardship of resources, in both your Uncle Charlie example and the Helga Langley case, the problem with the kind of stewardship that we're used to talking about talking about stewardship of someone else's dollars in most instances. And since there's no direct way you look at the use of those resources. For example, the Helga Langley case, the case actually cost, I believe, $1 million over the course of hospitalization. She had something left in Medicare coverage.
Insurance.
So the actual out-of-pocket expenditures for that family were probably in the area of a couple thousand dollars. Now, at that point, how you look at stewardship of resources is a different issue, as opposed to...
I would argue it's perceived as a different issue, but it ought not to be perceived as a different issue. It's the tragedy of the commons. We say, if I'm not going to suffer from throwing trash on the roadside because I'm going to Idaho, I'll throw trash on the roadside. If I'm not going to have to pay for it, I won't consider cost. The resources are still very real resources. They do take things away from other things. There's no way to avoid that. The only way Helga Wangley's care using $700,000, $1 million of resources over the whole period, could not take something away from other people in the society is if she were to produce an extra million in her lifetime to take care of that possible contingency, or she and other cohort fellow human beings were all to buy more expensive insurance beforehand as a kind of investment, deciding that that's where their earnings, because they're either extra earnings or just where they choose to put their earnings that stay of a certain level, ought to go, should go. That, I have no quarrel whatsoever with people buying health insurance beforehand. That would, in fact, provide care in Helga Wangley's precise case, even if it costs $1 million. But it ought to be because they say the resources that they have control of and produce ought to be invested in that, because life, even in persistent vegetative state, is worth that. But what you've got in the Helga Wangley case is, I think, the family. I can't get inside the family's head here, heads. But I would think it's not a case of taking the economics seriously because simply other people are paying the bill. But that's not an excuse any longer. It can't be unless we are all free riders. It really is a fundamental moral element of free riding on the community here.
But you haven't you then really put your finger on the major problem in our society, that we all think that as individuals our rights are more important than the rights of the community, and in fact we don't have communities in this country.
Yes, to some extent. That is, people's willingness to be free riders at the expense of others is a very serious problem in our society. But I would argue that you don't have to go to a, this is where I get in big debates with some other theologians and ethicists and philosophers. My argument would be you don't need to go to a larger communalist ethic in order to get some grip on controlling costs in healthcare in these situations. You can go to a very individualistic framework. You just ask people what they, with their values, would choose to invest in if they had looked at this problem beforehand. And I bet you anything, Helga Wangley would have said, don't spend $1 million on me in persistent vegetative state if that issue had been confronted her. Not because she cares about the, not because the community is controlling the situation, not because she ought to think about the community, but just because she wants to think about what those, she wants those resources not to go to her. Still very individualistic. So an individualist, putting limits on what we spend on healthcare is something that people of all moral stripes in our society, all ideologies, from communalists to individualists, can get on the bandwagon of, I would argue. And therefore, we shouldn't turn this into a big ideological debate between the individualists who say individual rights to life always supersede the community's need for resources versus, and the communalists on the other hand saying, no, then, I'm really afraid of the community dictating the value of life in terms of what life is worth in dollars in this kind of situation. I would rather leave it up with the individual, an individual with a conscience, and an individual thinking back about what they would want on Earth with the resources that they had control of.
Let me check out.
Excuse me, one final follow-up.
Are you then kind of saying that this is, in terms of calculating costs, it's kind of like asking companies who produce things to take into account the cost of cleaning up the mess that their product causes in when they sell the product.
Exactly. Now, there's a lot of cover-up costs. I'll get to that in a smoking case on Wednesday, but there's a lot of hokey-pokey that's being played with smoking costs. And companies are getting away with murder economically.
Yes.
In saying we don't want our employees to smoke and we'll give them big breaks if they don't, because that lowers our insurance costs, but what it actually does is increase insurance costs for the rest of society because non-smokers live longer and run up later, bigger costs later. So companies are free riding. Companies are free riding on the rest of society. That's only one element of it. There's a lot of free riding going on. It's not just by individuals. Yes?
It just seems to me that the massive insurance costs that you're developing for society, it all goes back to a basic question. You have to decide whether the individual is responsible for himself or whether society is responsible for the individual. It seems to me that if you assume, right now we pretty much assume that society is responsible for the individual. Once you accept that, then it's easy to take the free ride. And I think it may be, I hate to say naive, but I think it is a little bit naive to ask people to make decisions that may be against their personal interests when their life is involved. And this woman believed that her life would be better served by spending $1 million of society's money to preserve it for a moment. If her husband thought that's what she wanted, I don't know how you can say that she didn't want it. Perhaps she shouldn't have wanted it. Perhaps it's an educational problem that should have been addressed by her church as she was growing up or by her schools as she was growing up. But I think perhaps a more valuable focus is to look at what society can do now, and perhaps I think you're thinking about this, but what can society do to reduce the expenses that are made either on a national or a state or a local basis by governmental entities to pay for long-term care and to shift the focus to having the individuals make the decisions on what's spent for their care?
You mean from the start, so that the society doesn't support health insurance?
Well, perhaps it doesn't support it, certainly to the extent that it's supporting it now. I guess I'm saying you have to cut it back and probably cut it back a lot and perhaps cut it back all the way.
We'll get to some of those questions on Thursday night, access and structural reform in the major forum. There are a lot of things you said, some of which I agree and some of which I don't agree with. But my main reaction is that there is a dimension that I would call personal integrity here that has been so frequently missing in the way we think about these things. Integrity is thinking about your life in more than just the current moment. We ask teenagers to think not just about what they're doing in their room that night, but to tell us whether they want to go out with the family next tomorrow afternoon to the ball game and we got to buy tickets for them, et cetera.
My sense is, though, from what you're saying, that there's no reason why, given sufficient time, that communism wouldn't work. It's very plausible that each person should go what he needs and from each person should come what he can contribute. It's a noble thought, but it just doesn't seem to work.
Well, I'm not sure what the...
Well, it seems to me that what we're doing here is the same thing. Everybody's sucking in as much medical care as they can get, and they're paying out as much medical insurance as they're being...
You're saying that's partly or significantly because people weren't told right at the start that their medical care is their responsibility.
I think it's a... Perhaps.
Since society has said it's society's responsibility in part, i.e. yeah, we'll subsidize it, we'll have Medicare, et cetera, then people take license and run up the bill without consideration of the cost. That will, of course, create, inevitably, one of two reactions. Either our society is going to go downhill economically because we don't put a stop to the escalation of costs, or society will just put a clamp on what can be spent in certain situations, which certainly is going to inevitably run roughshod over individual values in particular cases. Or thirdly, they can go your direction and say, let's get out of this communal support for health care to begin with. And in fact, you find proposals of the latter two stripes prominent in the options that various organizations and politicians have put forward for reforming the system. We'll certainly pursue that more later in the week. I don't know who's next here. Jane, maybe.
The question you made about how many names with physicians and other healthcare professionals who describe it as futile, and you said that was an inappropriate description because of the memory that's left. I'd like to ask you a little bit about, the dying has become a remarkably private affair, and perhaps one of the most public things that we do. Being born, being married, dying are things that have to be registered in this country as well as a sort of public knowledge. And that one of the difficulties is that, as I read the article, and I didn't talk to anybody involved with this, I'm saying in the Kazan case, that in those last periods of time, actually some of the people who are closest to you are precisely the healthcare professionals. And so that a description of what's futile or meaningful is I wouldn't see their judgments as really being, you said, looking for an objective definition. That's where the family you see as a unit kind of takes priority in defining what gives it meaning, a pleasant memory left behind. But what memory does it leave behind for all of us or for those who care for her? And how, in that sense, that debate about what legacy do we leave when we die? I mean, Hilda Wang is what kind of an unfortunate one for us as her fellow citizens, especially in Minnesota. And Nancy Kruzan, again, another. So that's the place. How can we debate that?
I think that is by far the best way to try to support the physician's position in this case. But it's not what I heard, at least for the newspaper articles, the physicians arguing. What the physicians were arguing is, in our profession, this was not a statement that was involved in a lot of relationship with Helga at all. It was simply a statement that, given the medical profession, we are not in the business of keeping people who are irreversibly unconscious alive. They were trying to make an objective claim about futility.
I say, one, I know what you mean. You think, well, thanks a lot. You know, burn all the Bunsen burner. Let's get on to the next experiment. But what I never hear is how much of a kind of rhetoric we encourage that they speak of.
Yes. Very good.
Anybody who's working, and if you talk to the health people day by day or on the floors, hospitals, wherever, to care for someone, the gentleman over there was saying, I've seen these people and the cost of it. I think that they, at least my experience with healthcare professionals, are profoundly moral questions, and we don't always know how to give them the right to speak in that kind of language of what they feel and experience. Medical principles.
Yeah, and there are also some subtleties in the Wangley case about what they were saying, what they were actually recommending. They did give the family the option of finding. They didn't just say we refuse to continue the ventilator and the artificial food and water. They said instead, family, we will help you look for another provider who will do this. We're not going to do it. We'll help you look for another provider who will do it. If we don't find one, we'll go to court to get permission to withdraw this ourselves, which is a way of saying, admitting that their value is not objective, their value is just their value in this situation. But then when they found that there wasn't another provider around who would take the case, they stuck by their guns and said, we still insist that the care be withdrawn, and we'll go to in court to get that enforced. And all this was done, I think, in a quite sensitive way from reading the internal document that I saw from the Hennepin County Hospital on it. Namely, they had some long conversations with the family about the situation. Yes, Jean?
I know we only have 1 minute left, so I'll talk fast. I'm speaking as a hospital chaplain, so I see this every day, and I can't stress enough that how important I think it is to make these decisions before you hit the hospital, because once you're in their hands, grips, I would say, and you're in the emergency room, waiting room, and your loved one is in the emergency room, you lose control, because they are the doctors, they are the nurses, and it's their job to bring this person back to life. I was in a situation where someone was pronounced dead, but they kept trying to bring them back. You know, all the brain waves, there was no brain waves, there was no heartbeat, there was nothing. We had prepared the family The ER doctor and I, that was not going well. The person wasn't probably not going to make it. We had just gotten everything ready for the neurologist to come in, we thought, and tell them that their loved one was dead. Instead, the neurologist did his test. We all three walked in, talked to the family, and he said, we're taking your loved one upstairs. We're going to put them in the intensive care. We're hooking them up to this. We're hooking them up to that. And my eyes just got bigger in the ER room. Doctor looked at me, and I looked at him, and we all three walked out. And I walked up to him, and I don't know where I got the nerve to do this as a mere chaplain, but I said, I thought you said to me a little bit ago that he was dead. And he said, well, yes. He is dead. And I said, well, then why are we taking him up to the emergency room and hooking up to all this when that's just